Welcome back to the Religious Studies Project. I'm Christopher Cotter, and I am here with David Robertson. Say hello, David.
Hello, David.
Thank you, thank you. We are still in the Bow Bar in Edinburgh. We always seem to stay in pubs or on trains, as someone pointed out this week when we were on the train back from Sockrill, that it seemed like the train took an entire week to get back from Durham to Edinburgh. We seem to stay in pubs for an entire week as well. We're still on the same pint, of course. We always drag those out for a week as well.
Nurse those for a week.
The Religious Studies Project is brought to you by the British Association for the Study of Religions, as always. So I just want to big them up before we get into the interview. This week's interview is David speaking with Martin Stringer of the University of Birmingham on a situational belief. So I think we'll just go straight into the interview. Does that sound okay to you, David?
Sounds fine.
Okay.
Take it away, David.
Action.
Belief is a highly important term in the study of religion. For some scholars, indeed, belief is the very essence of religion. As Clifford Geertz put it, to know, one must first believe. Increasingly, religious traditions are referred to in the public sphere as faiths. Whereas other scholars see the focus on belief as the result of the Protestant bias in the development of the discipline and have proposed various ways of avoiding using the term at all, including the material religion approach, which is being discussed at the Sockrill conference where we're recording today. But belief continues to be an important concept both for scholars and for practitioners, but it is certainly more complex than it might at first appear. To discuss belief and situational belief in particular, I'm joined today by Professor Martin Stringer, who is Professor of Liturgical and Congregational Studies, as well as Deputy Pro-Vice-Chancellor at the Department of Theology and Religion at the University of Birmingham. So welcome to the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with the fieldwork that you did, which led to your book and the model of situational belief.
Okay, the field work that led specifically to the situational belief came through a number of things I was doing in Manchester, particularly working with the different Anglican churches of the Ardwick Deanery, and listening to the way people within the churches at that particular point were talking about things that were important to them, but more importantly, talking within the context of study groups or within the context, in one case, of a sort of parent and toddler group, conversations, discussions amongst themselves, not as part of interviews. And I think that's important in terms of situational belief. So what I was picking up was a series of contradictory statements that people were saying different things at different times. So the one case I pick up is in terms of death, which was in the context of a discussion group. And at one level, people were willing to assert the importance of requiems for people who had died. At another point in the same conversation, people wanted to say that for them, what was important was reincarnation and the possibility of coming back. So it was identifying in those kind of conversations, people making different statements at different times that seemed to be contradictory, but they weren't aware of those contradictions coming up.
And so you get this situation where, the beliefs or the expression of those beliefs varies in the in the situation that the agent is, the actor is in. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes. I sort of turned it round in a sense and started to talk about belief statements.
Yeah.
So in a sense, the question of whether they are expressing a belief that they themselves hold, I put as sort of secondary. Mm-hmm. So what I'm really doing is listening to the statements that people use. And what I suggest is that there are a number of statements that are available that people meet in their lives, and they choose to use the one that's most appropriate to the point of, within the conversation. Mm-hmm. So for this particular congregation, which was a Catholic Anglican congregation, they had a number of statements that they could use about death. And in a sense, I'm not asking the question, you know, do they believe these statements in that sense? It's, you know, do they think of them beyond the point at which they use them? Mm-hmm. But at one point in the conversation, the statement that it is important to hold a requiem for some relative who has died in order for them to get to heaven is an important statement. It makes sense of that situation.
Okay.
At another point, when they start to think about themselves, what actually is important is that I will come back again, and therefore, you know, it's a different statement, it's a different phrase that is picked up.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation I develop is the idea that at a different point we are the position I'm developing is that within the sort of traditional context of something like Christianity, we have this assumption that all beliefs are connected, that there is a system, and if you believe one, you're going to believe all the others that come through, and therefore you get the creed and all that sort of stuff. What I'm suggesting is that actually as that becomes less dominant in the way people think about things, people are picking and choosing the belief statements they want to use to make sense of their lives, and then follow those through. And therefore, you know, there can be contradictions mm-hmm. or differences.
I think it's that multiplicity, though, that I find very interesting about your work on situational belief, because the sort of picking and choosing of beliefs, in quote marks, and practices that help people make sense of their lives, it's quite a familiar description of kind of, you know, like vernacular religion, alternate spiritualities, new age, you will. But what you're talking about is a multiplicity of sometimes contradictory or at least complex mm-hmm. Belief statements within individuals.
Yes.
Now, this really kind of problematizes the way that we think about beliefs.
Yes.
You know, with the plural.
Sure.
So perhaps you could say something about that.
Again, it problematizes it only if we work on the two assumptions that sort of underline that standard. One is that we're talking about something that is systematic,
mm-hmm.
that religion is about people sort of making meaning of the world, and that people think through their religious beliefs, their religious ideas, and that somehow, you know, we are expected to be coherent and consistent. And that assumption that, you know, a religion is taken as a complete package, and we think about it in that way. And that, you know, that's one thing I'm challenging,
mm-hmm.
that actually for most ordinary people, that complete whole simply isn't there.
Yeah.
They're picking as they need it, not in connection with the whole.
Yeah.
The other side where it problematizes the traditional understanding of belief is that we have this view of belief that somehow has that sort of emotional content that is something that is profoundly held.
Yes, yes.
And in a sense, I'm suggesting that we need to sort of sit much more loosely to some of these beliefs. If I take another example, one of the other examples I quote in the book is in terms of the parent and toddler group, that where the mothers come and sit around the table drinking coffee and talking about astrology.
Yeah.
And talking about their stars. Now, the move from a very jokey, very sort of informal conversation, oh, have you read your stars today, mm-hmm. kind of thing, to a point where actually it becomes very serious. Something, a real issue has come up. Therefore, you know, there are people in Blackpool who you can go and consult about this and you can actually get a solution to your problem. That move from the jokiness to something that is really very serious, I wouldn't want to use the word profound, but serious, is also part of what I'm trying to say about sort of situational mm-hmm. belief. That actually, you know, a lot of these statements you can sit very loose to most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, if we don't see them as coherent, you know, we can accept all sorts of different things. But there will be times, usually at times of illness, uncertainty, concern, pain, whatever, where actually they start to become very serious, very important. And that's the point at which, you know, people will start to use them much more significantly.
I'm quite glad you brought up that that example of the astrology. I don't know if you've come across Nicholas Campion's work on astrology. He, I saw him speaking recently. In fact, we interviewed him. But in his talk, he gave some statistics from a survey that he'd done, researching people's attitudes to belief in astrology. Right now, he took a variety of groups from a sort of a New Age kind of group to a group of chemistry students and things. So, you know, quite a range of what you'd expect. And he asked them, do you believe in astrology?
Right.
And it was fairly low. I mean, I think it was between 30 and 40%, I think, in the New Age group, but way down 5 or 10 in the chemistry class. But he asked the same groups, have you looked up the compatibility of your star sign and your partner?
Yep.
And right across the board, it was about 70%.
Right.
So there, the situation mattered. These weren't, what would you call, propositional beliefs. But in certain circumstances, they motivated their behaviour.
Yes.
Exactly.
And that's the kind of thing I'm trying to sort of get at. That actually, the importance we give to these kind of statements, the importance we give to the beliefs, will vary. Mm-hmm. In different contexts, in different places, and it, as a motivation of behaviour, is where you start to sort of see these things at work.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if you're simply going to ask people, "Do you believe this? Do you believe that? Do you believe the other?"
Yeah,
it depends how you pick it up.
But that's exactly what we do in censuses, though, isn't it?
Of course, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, and therefore we're not going to find the right kind of information.
Yeah.
And you know, the work of Abby Day and the way she's looked at the census and what the census is actually trying to tell us in terms of identity, I think makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But that's a very small part of the overall discourse, if you like, on religion that exists within society.
Of course, of course. The first point you made about the coherence of people's worldview, now, you're making a very different statement than I think the majority of scholars do, particularly in things like, I mean, I thought of Festinger's, you know, when prophecy fails immediately, because that's very much his entire argument, is that, you know, the whole theory of cognitive dissonance states we cannot hold contradictory beliefs.
Yes.
And it's exactly opposite of what you're saying.
Yes.
And it is a bit of a sacred cow, I think.
I don't know whether it's a sacred cow or not. But then, in a sense, that comes to the sort of basic, what you were talking about at the beginning and, you know, where I start the book, that too much of our thinking about religion has actually started from a very Protestant Christian position.
Yeah.
And behind that is there is a sort of philosophical tradition as well that sort of says we have to be coherent, we have to be logical, we have to be consistent, and all the rest of that. But that is, you know, that's, you know, a highly academic position. Mm-hmm. It's a position that, you know, if you think about things long enough, that's where you will end up. The sort of philosophical, theological tradition that has developed, particularly in the West, has made that assumption. That, you know, these are sacred cows, these are things that we cannot go beyond, and the psychological tradition sort of then takes that on and says, you know, it causes cognitive dissonance and so on. But actually, if you listen to what people are saying, if you spend enough time with people in different kinds of situations, there's enough anthropological evidence to suggest that people do actually shift their position. They will say one thing in one place, they will say something different in another, they will say something different in another. What Gerd Bauman talks about in terms of sort of dominant discourses and demotic discourses, but he also talks about sort of dual discursive competence, that we have the ability to move between these discourses quite easily and without really causing ourselves any problem. We don't always notice we're doing it. And actually sort of listening to the language that people use every day, we're doing that all the time.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And so why shouldn't we do it in religion?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, to stick with the Festinger thing, I mean, he had this very small group of people that he was looking at, but he ignored the larger context of sort of prophetic movements, which is that most of the people who follow prophets don't stop saving for their kids' college, or, you know, don't cancel their insurance. You know,
yes.
They're sort of exercising both both kinds of beliefs at the same time.
Yep.
Yeah. What are the broader implications of this then? I mean, first of all, I mean, we've kind of touched on it a wee bit already, but what then does this tell us about the nature of belief and faith from a broader perspective?
I'm not sure that it can tell us anything about the nature of faith.
Okay, well,
belief and faith are very different.
Let's talk about that, actually, because I meant to ask that earlier on. What would you say the difference is?
I'm using belief much more in terms of an element of language, an element of talking about things. It comes back to that question of are we automatically assuming that profound commitment to the statement that people are using, or is it something that is said in passing as it moves through?
Yes.
Now, it's not to deny that there are people out there within the churches, within other religious groups, who have that profound belief, that profound faith.
Okay.
And that's, you know, but that's a small minority.
Yeah, yeah.
On a broader cross-section, actually, those two don't necessarily go together.
Yeah.
You're stating beliefs on a much less sort of committed position.
Uh-huh.
And so that's, you know, one thing that I'm working on. Faith, I'm not sure that I've ever worked out what faith is really about. I wrote a very sort of naughty introduction to the book on the inside of outside a problem on the question of ritual.
Okay.
Which I co-edited with Elizabeth Arvek. But the introduction to that, I basically said that faith is a discourse that the religious use to keep the academics out.
That's always been my suspicion as well, yeah.
There's something there that we will never understand.
Yeah.
No, nonsense. But that's faith.
Yeah.
I think the more sort of significant things in terms of belief and what understanding of situational belief can add to a sort of broader understanding of religion. Two things.
Before we get there, I need to ask the other side of that question.
Go on.
How does situational belief then, you seem to be situating it in language, largely.
Yes.
How does that relate to, say, knowledge? I'm not quite sure of how the terminology would work in philosophy, say, but I believe that when I put my cup down on this table, it won't fall through. Or do I know that? What's the difference between that and... That's not a situational belief.
Belief, no. Yes, I do track through in the book some of that sort of more philosophical question, drawing very much on the work of Dansberger.
Mm-hmm.
And issues of, again, belief statements, looking at the construction of belief statements. Now, you know, philosophers are not going to agree on all these things and where we actually want to draw the line between belief and knowledge. In my view, what you've just said in terms of the cup on the table is a question of knowledge.
Okay.
You know your cup will not go through. What Dansberger argues is that belief statements start to come into play when actually they're unverifiable through most empirical processes. Uh-huh. The example he uses is all leopards are Christians. Actually, we have no way of finding that out.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong,
mm-hmm.
but it's the kind of statement that you can't verify. So when you're talking about life after death, or when you're talking about, you know, meet the compatibility between yourself and your partner in the stars or whatever,
yeah.
you know, that's where belief comes in, because you actually have to almost assert something over and above the evidence that's available.
Absolutely.
Whereas actually every time you put that cup down, or at least, you know,
yes,
it will hit that table. So that's knowledge. But it is the case, and you do get there's a strong evangelical discourse that sort of denies belief and says, actually, you know, we know that God is there.
Yeah.
We know that, you know, Jesus saved us.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll say, you know, we'll use the same kind of structure, but put it much more on the knowledge side.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I'm saying when I'm saying it is language.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's really interesting. I do think, though, that we in religious studies, we really need to really clarify kind of what we mean by beliefs and what we mean by knowledge and what we mean by faith, because they're often mixed up.
We use the language far too loosely.
Yeah.
And we move very quickly between them and assume we're talking about the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that's part of the issue that I'm trying to sort of get at underneath this. Yeah.
And so I'll let you get back to the issues underneath this. This has interesting implications for our understandings, our models of religion.
Yeah. I would put it in two ways. First, in terms of actually looking, we are modelling religion most of the times on the basis of something like Christianity, religions.
Yes.
In that sense, as opposed to religion. So what people are doing, how people engage, and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to find and what I'm doing within the book on some contemporary Western ethnography and the definition of religion is actually just saying, if we talk about where people actually engage on those issues of death, on issues of suffering, on issues of sickness, whatever, in uncertainty,
mm-hmm.
we find these kind of situational beliefs. Now, you talk to people who are either very much on the edge of churches or outside religious contexts, you see these things all the time, you see the contradiction, you know what's there,
mm-hmm.
and you can posit, yes, you know, these are people who've not been brought up within a particular belief, faith, tradition, therefore they're having to choose mm-hmm. their own things. Now, having observed it there, I would also posit that you could actually take it back in amongst the people who are much more sort of clearly self-identified as religious,
mm-hmm.
and you can see they're actually doing the same kind of thing,
yeah.
but we don't notice it because it's hidden within a much more consistent discourse.
Yes, yes.
So the first thing I would say is that actually this is much more sort of fundamental to the way most people express religious ideas,
yes.
than the models that we often use. And therefore, I'm saying this, I suppose, the second thing is that as we're moving into a society where Christian discourses, Christian language is becoming less and less dominant for all yeah. sorts of reasons, mm-hmm. then actually we're not seeing necessarily, I mean, it goes back to the sort of secularisation debate, not necessarily seeing a decline in this sort of baseline of religion. That's still existing, that's still going on, but people are using much more diverse statements in order to make sense of what's happening around them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a very useful idea to take out into the field, actually, rather than, you know, as I was saying earlier on about that kind of alternative spirituality, pick and mix, people yeah. constructing coherent worldviews.
No.
I think if I'm understanding you right, there's a kind of positing a sort of substrata that's kind of always been there, but rather neglected because we've been focusing on the more sort of formulated theology of the, well, of the elite forms of these religions. You know?
Yes, exactly. Or when, you know, you just have to look through the sort of anthropological literature. When anthropologists have gone out to study other societies, they've tried to find an equivalent.
Yes.
They've tried to put it all together coherently.
Yeah.
And actually, if you look at something like Sir Evans Pritchard's Newer Religion,
uh-huh.
yes, he's trying to make a complete theory of it, but you look at what those people are doing. They're using some beliefs about water spirits at this point. They're using other beliefs about sort of other kinds of spirits at another point. There isn't a coherency there.
Yeah.
There doesn't need to be.
Yeah. It's like the famous story where Portuguese missionary meets the East African tribe. And they have the fetish there, mm-hmm. which is, they've obviously manufactured. And he says to them, well, look, is this a real divine object or is this something that you've made? And they answer, well, both. They don't see any need for that coherence or that distinction.
That distinction in that case, yeah.
yeah.
So, and, you know, it does away with a lot of the debate about syncretism.
Yes, it does.
Because it assumes that's normative rather than the exception.
And I think it also it allows us to talk about sort of indigenous religions in a different way as well, because if we're talking about these situational beliefs in that sort of ad hoc sense and existing largely in language, then there are much clearer parallels between, you know, say African religion or, you know, whatever indigenous religion you want to talk about, and the on-the-ground data in contemporary Christian Britain, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. And that, I would certainly posit that very strongly.
So where are you going next with this? Are you going to continue to work in it, or is that kind of all there is to be said? I mean, I can certainly see other applications for this. I haven't actually cited you, but I probably will end up citing you. And I write a lot about conspiracy theorism,
right?
And there's a number of parallels.
They can be yes,
that people will express a certain situation in, you know, relation to ideas about death or other kinds of threats, but then in their everyday life, mm-hmm. not be acting in that way most of the time.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the way I've used it, I've not referenced situation or belief as such, but the latest book that I've just written will be coming out in August, is on the ways in which people in Birmingham talk about religious diversity.
Okay.
And again, picking up the complexity of some of that, mm-hmm. we have this assumption that people will either say all religion is good or all religion is bad, and that, you know, Islamophobia is the thing that dominates the way people talk about things. No. Mm-hmm. People will, at certain points, when they listen to something in the news or whatever, make negative comments about Islam or whatever. At other times, in other contexts, mm-hmm. they will say something very different. And what I've been interested in doing in sort of listening around Birmingham is when people are talking about dress, their understanding of religious diversity tends to be more negative. When people are talking about buildings, certainly in Birmingham now, mm-hmm. Where a lot of the religious buildings have community facilities built into them, it's actually far more positive, and they're mm-hmm. celebrating. And then you go out and you go to the Fisaki celebrations on the streets, and everybody is saying how wonderful it is that we're so diverse, mm-hmm. and, you know, there are so many religions here. Uh-huh. And that is situational belief, done in a slightly different way, uh-huh. but it is looking at the complexity and saying, actually, we can't talk about religious diversity in simple terms.
Yeah,
there are many different discourses out there, but we have to look at the context in which they are told, the stories are told.
Oh, that's great. I mean, really fascinating discussion, so thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and I'm sure we're going to have plenty of responses.
Good.
Thank you.
I look forward to that.
You've just been listening to David speaking to Martin Stringer about situational belief. So thank you to Martin and to David for that interview. So we've got a few things we want to chat to you about now. We've got next week's interview. We've got another bit of conference news. But we've just been sitting here sort of obsessing about our statistics for a while. So I think David's going to run you through those.
Well, yes. Okay. First of all, Facebook, 945 likes. Now, we made an announcement at 500 about how pleased we were. We decided to forego 750. But the allure of that magical, although arbitrary, 1,000 mark is too much for us to contain. You know, come on, there must be somebody you know in your department who doesn't already like the Religious Studies Project on Facebook. Or even outside of your department, hey, there must be lots of people in your circles on the social medias that would love this kind of...
Or people who want to know what on earth it is that you do.
Yeah, indeed, that's an excellent suggestion. I mean, 945, we were trying to work out how many religious studies departments that would be.
You know, 5 to 10, probably.
Yeah.
Depending upon the size. And Edinburgh size, we'd be talking 10.
So, yeah, I mean, we're talking about a large circle here. That circle's even larger when we bring in our Twitter followers. It's something like 757, I believe.
797.
Okay, so almost 800 followers on Twitter. We've got around 200 followers via email.
Yeah, and who knows about RSS?
We don't know about RSS at all. We don't have a way to find that out. Certainly, that's how I subscribe. So, this is just to underline how big a community the Religious Studies Project has become. Which, you know, let's keep the debate going. This is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, community for undergraduates and people who are you know, not professionals, but tangentially involved and professional as well, to debate these things.
So use these social spaces, please use them. You know, they're going to waste if you don't.
And you know, if you've got if the link to your event isn't going to our Opus Digest, which comes out every Friday, goes out on our Facebook page, on Twitter, on the website, then you're missing a huge targeted audience there.
Need we say more?
Need we say more? So we won't say more. We'll start talking about this conference.
Yeah, well, it's kind of the same thing, you know, because it's such a big resource. It's another Open University event, and David was saying last week about how we've been invited down to the event in Milton Keynes in May. There's another one happening in London, an Open University event that's being organised by Tim Hutchings. Our pal did an interview with him, certain the response, he participated in our panel session a couple of weeks ago. And he's organising an event called Digital Media and Sacred Text. So I'm going to be going down to that in London. Hopefully, I haven't confirmed at this stage, hopefully attending another event the following day on Religion and the Census. And I'll be bringing you, as David did last week, you know, Facebook updates, Twitter updates, some photographs, and some reportage from that conference, and we're very grateful for that opportunity as well.
What do we have next week? We've got an interview with Ralph Hood on mysticism, is that the title?
Yeah, and it's our pal Chris Silver once again. It's been a while since we had a Chris Silver one. So.
Yes, we've got one more from Chris Silver coming up in a few weeks' time. For now, it's just the usual tail end. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, make sure you use our Amazon.co.uk and Amazon.com links if you're in the US. That's supporting the project at no additional cost to yourself.
Yeah, that's so many people I know use Amazon all the time and they keep forgetting to use the link and then feel very ashamed when I mention, oh, did you use our link? So, you know, just again, feel the shame. Please use the link.
How dare you?
How dare you? How could you live with yourselves?
But other than that,
we're just going to say thanks for listening.